Audi.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. To any of our regular listeners, you might have noticed that we've had a few weeks break over the last month or so. I've been in Spain for 6 weeks and also I've been on holiday, I have to say. There's been a bit of holidaying, but there's been a lot of working as well because I've been busy working on two wonderful new podcast series. The first is the India Hicks podcast. It's with India Hicks and Lady Pamela Hicks. Lady Pamela is the 90-year-old daughter of Lord Mountbatten, who was Prince Charles's uncle and great advisor, and also uncle to Prince Philip, and also a relative of the Queen, very close to the royal family. I'm sure most of you have heard of him. And I have to say, it's been at times a spine-tingling privilege to sit having tea and cake in Lady Pamela's drawing room with her and her lovely daughter, India Hicks, in Oxfordshire, and listen firsthand to the stories of her famous family, of royals, lords and ladies, Serena's Tsars and more, the very famous people that visited the Mountbattens, you know, from Wallace Simpson to Noel Coward and all these glittering characters who are now actually consigned to history. Lady Pamela was the Queen's bridesmaid when she got married. Actually, it was Princess Elizabeth. She was Princess Elizabeth's bridesmaid when she got married because she wasn't yet the Queen. But she was actually also on the famous Commonwealth tour when Princess Elizabeth did find out she was going to be Queen. She was there that moment. Indeed, this week's podcast tells of the very poignant moment at treetops in Kenya. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story where Princess Elizabeth is told that sadly her father has passed away, the king, and she now will be queen. Lady Pamela was there to witness that, and the story is really, really incredible. Elizabeth was only 25, a very young princess, and had to fly home, and Lady Pamela tells us all about this poignant journey she had and almost the change that was almost visible, she says, in her knowing that her life was going to change forever. So the other podcast I've released in this time, the podcast series, I'm incredibly excited to say, is a podcast series with the veritable legend of a BBC foreign correspondent, John Simpson. John actually came on the Big Travel Podcast not so long ago. If you haven't heard that episode, do have a listen. He enjoyed it so much, he decided to make his own series with me. And I'm overjoyed that he chose to do it with me. He could have gone to the BBC, where he's been working for over 53 years. But actually, he chose to do it independently. And for the first season, it was meant to be an interview-based podcast, but due to various logistics, for the first season, it's just John and I talking about current events and affairs and some fascinating insights he has. You know, he's travelled the world for 53 years as a foreign correspondent. He's met Putin, Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, and all these very, very historical events. And we're covering all sorts of subjects on the podcast on the first season. I'm busy lining up a stellar range of guests, I would say, some very famous people for season two. So do give that a listen, the India Hicks podcast and also John Simpson's World. So it's been very busy while I've been in Spain, but here we are back with a new Big Travel Podcast and some amazing guests lined up for the foreseeable future. Starting here with, would you believe it, a NASA astronaut. NASA astronaut John Herrington became the first ever Native American to travel to space during a historic mission to the International Space Station. He lives in the Idaho wilderness, flies his own plane, has cycled over 4,000 miles cross-country from Washington to Florida, and for his most recent adventure is one of two U.S. trailblazers exploring America in an incredible film called Into America's Wild. His inspirational stories have landed him a very well-suited role as a motivational speaker, and he's here now to motivate and inspire us all. Let's start with space. What does it feel like?
Oh boy, it's a hard question to answer because there's so many aspects to it. The launch is real exciting. It takes 8.5 minutes to get to orbit. You go from zero to 17,500 miles an hour, or 28,000, I think, kilometers per hour in 8.5 minutes. And you get up, and you start floating. Everything around you is floating. You're floating. You have to hang on. You're not used to hanging on and to stay in one place. So it takes a little bit to get used to.
Are you scared?
No, I wasn't scared. I think you realize if you're worried about all the things that could go wrong, then you probably shouldn't be there because a lot of things can go wrong.
Can a lot of things go wrong? I mean, I know about the technology must be brilliant. The technology blows my mind. I don't understand how they can get you into space. I still don't understand flying, really.
Sure. Well, space shuttle is an extremely complex vehicle. It was an extremely complex. It's in museums now. But, you know, so many things can go wrong. And so for a long time, we're in simulators, and we constantly simulate all the bad stuff that could happen. And our job is to respond to the bad stuff. And so when you fly and bad stuff doesn't happen, you're like, whew, that's good. I made it. Yay.
What's that moment like when you take off? Because it looks and sounds so incredible and loud.
Well, the noise is behind you. Once you start going is past the speed of sound, you don't really hear it. You hear the radios. You hear the chatter on the radios. You hear there's a lot of vibration. And it's really bumpy for about 2 minutes. And then when the solids, you have these two big rocket engines on the outside that are solid rocket engines. And so they burn really violently and makes it really kind of bumpy. And after 2 minutes, they fall away and it gets to be very smooth. So you're on three main engines that push you the rest of the way to space. And then it feels like, people describe it as an electric train ride.
Is David Bowie's Space Oddity going through your mind?
Oh, no, that's Chris Hadfield. He's a Canadian that sang that when he was on the space station, but no. Actually, I took 2001, A Space Odyssey. I took the soundtrack to that when I went to space.
You know, I think this is a very important question, and actually my music question is, we might have almost already answered it, but it's always a question I ask at the end. But on the way to meet you, you know, David Bowie's Space Oddity was going round in my head, and I'm thinking of all those things that can go wrong. You can actually... You know, you can be forgotten. Wouldn't be forgotten, but you could be lost. You could be lost in space.
Well, one of the guys, Tom Stafford, General Tom Stafford from Oklahoma, where I'm from, Major Tom, you know, in that, and so when Chris Hadfield sang it and made that connection, you know, that people want to see the human aspect of flying in space, and when Chris sang that song, then it kind of made the connection.
So you were heading for the International Space Station, which is, as far as I'm aware, as large as a football field and is flying around us even as we speak.
Right. It's been in space. It launched. The first humans went on board the space station in November of 2000. So we've been in space, you know, 19 years, since almost 19 years. I mean, it's always been somebody on board. I think pretty soon there'll be 9 people on board, usually six. But it orbits the Earth every 90 minutes. And, you know, there's an app on your phone. You can actually see when it comes over, and you can watch. It's the brightest star in the sky in the early morning, the early evening.
My brother has this app, and I've seen it. And I haven't
got
downloaded
the app.
The app looks great. I don't know why. I keep thinking of downloading the app and watching it go over, and I have seen it. And it's very different movement to, say, a shooting star when you actually see it.
It just moves across the sky really fast. There's no blinking lights. It's just a reflection of the sunlight on the structure. And so if you see it in the evening, it eventually passes into darkness, through what we call the Terminator, and it'll disappear.
How does it even get up there, or has it been built up there slowly,
it's been built.
A bit like Lego?
Yeah, 16 different countries have been involved in the manufacture and assembly, and so the space shuttle was a truck, essentially, and it carried up a large number of the elements to the space station. The Russians also launched a lot. The Europeans have a module they send up, no module, but a transfer vehicle that goes up as well. The Japanese do the same. SpaceX is doing the same as well. So, yeah. And I think Orbital ATK, so there's commercial entities that are actually flying payloads up to space.
Yeah. So how do you get attached to it? How do you get on? There you are hurtling through the sky at whatever speed? What speed are you going up?
17,500. So I've got to do my metric here.
About
20. I think it's around 28,000 kilometers per hour, I think. So I got to go back and do the math.
So you're hurtling through
really fast
the sky,
really
towards
fast
space.
Well, you go up in the idea is you don't launch straight up. You launch and you go around the Earth. Because when the engines quit, you're not accelerating anymore. And so gravity is pulling you back to Earth. Well, Earth is round. It's not flat. And you fall back to Earth, but you're going so fast that the Earth falls away at the same rate. So you're in this constant free fall around the Earth. To get to the space station, though, you have to fire the engines in a series of burns to catch up to it. Because it's in a higher orbit. And once you get up to it, you fly beneath it. And then you fly up in front of it. And then you slow down. So we're going together at really, really fast. But we dock at about, 10 feet per second or so, very, 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 very slowly, but you're going around the Earth together really fast.
It's really like something out of a movie. Does it feel like that when you're there and you, presumably somebody's connecting, not somebody, you're being connected somehow?
Well, it's way more fun than a movie, because it's real, It's a real experience, and to be able to see the space station out your window for the very first time, you look at it and you go, that's not fake. That is, no kidding, the real thing.
At that point, is your heart just thumping really fast, thinking we've got to connect to that thing?
Yeah, well, you've got to work hard. My responsibility on Rendezvous was to run the computers, because we have computers that are running that measure the speed and the distance and everything. We have cameras that look at everything. And the commander's job is to fly the vehicle by hand and to dock with it. And so when things get really close and this big, huge thing is coming down in front of the windows right here, and it's like, you're getting it right there.
Left a bit, right a bit.
Yeah, and he has to get it just right.
And then are you wearing, presumably you don't need to go outside at this point?
No,
we're
still
outside.
Did you go outside
at all?
Yeah, I did 3 spacewalks.
What does that feel like?
You hang on kind of tight for a little bit, because it's a long way down. And then what you realize, the harder you hang on, the more tired you'll get. And so you have to just hang on, just, thumb and a forefinger, really just lightly. But you're not space walking, you're actually space crawling. That sounds kind of funny. But you just use your hands. You never use your feet except if you're going to put them in a foot restraint. If you have to move something, if you have to move you have a lot of torque on a bolt, you push on, it's going to push back. And if you're not, your feet aren't held down, you're going to go around whatever you're pushing. So it's kind of interesting.
What happens if you let go?
If you let go, hopefully you're tethered. We have a tether that's about, it runs, it's on a little reel, and so it kind of follows you around. And then if you let go, you'd have to push off from the space station, and you'd float out a bit, and then that little reel would pull you back in, would reel you back in. If you're going to do work at a work site, then you have to put a big tether. You have a couple tethers on you. You hook the tether to it. So if you let go, you might float away a couple feet, maybe a meter at the most, and then pull yourself back in. If you really want to stay in position, there's another restraint you have that actually clamps onto a handrail, and you tighten it up, you're right there.
What does it feel like looking at Earth from that great distance?
Well, one spacewalk, I was looking over the back of the space station, and I was working, and I was really close to this structure I was not supposed to touch, this bright, bright white structure. As I looked down the back side of it, the Bahamas come into view. Speaking of the Bahamas, had recently had the major damage from the hurricane. But to see them float into view and to see the tongue of the ocean in that area of the Bahamas while you're working, that's neat.
Does it make you feel about the world differently? Because I always think that travel in itself helps broaden the mind, because you just realize that everyone's the same. Everyone's trying, black, white, whatever, religion, color, creed. Yeah. Everyone's trying to get on with their lives. And traveling to other countries helps you see that. But when you see Earth from such a distance, you really do realize we are one. We're just little human beings all trying to get on. And it must be ridiculous to consider war or conflict in that
sense.
You
feel really insignificant because you don't see the detail. Okay, when you travel across the country, I rode a bike across the United States. And I got to talk to people and the smells and the temperatures. So I felt that presence of folks and got to meet people. And it was a fabulous experience. In space, though, you're so far disconnected from it. And so you can't discern one from the other, which you say, we're all one. At night, you see just the beauty of all of the cities and all of these connections between places. I woke up. I took a nap one night on the flight deck. And it's hard to sleep because you're floating. But it's easy to take a nap. And so I took a nap on the flight deck, and I fell asleep in one spot, and I woke up in another, which is kind of cool. But I was looking out the window, and I went, it was night. Oh, that's the coast of England. There's London. There's the Pas de Calais. There's the coast of France and Paris, all in one right there. That was awesome.
It's amazing that you can see it that clearly.
Yeah.
You can see the city, the coastline.
Easy. It's very easy to discern that. And the nice thing about it is, you know, as a pilot, you're like, where am I? And you look down and you think, and you recognize where places are and you make that connection. So from space, it's in a much broader, more macro view. And then to be able to hear all of a sudden you're over Paris and pretty soon you're over the Middle East and you're over the Indian Ocean pretty quick. It takes 20 minutes to go from Sydney, Australia to Los Angeles in the space shuttle.
That's just awesome. I mean, there's so much I want to ask you. I want to ask you about your bike ride. I want to ask you about being the first Native American astronaut. But before, and also the film you're here talking about, you've made this incredible film. But before we do that, I want to ask how you get down from space.
You turn around and you slow down. Because you're going so fast that now to come home, you turn the space shuttle around, you fire the engines, and actually slows you down. So now you fall back into the atmosphere. And this is all computer controlled. You know, you send commands. The commander can actually fly it by hand if he has to, or she has to. But then it's this long fall, about 40-minute fall back to the Earth. And then you glide to a landing at the Kennedy Space Center or Edwards Air Force Base or one of those two places where you hope to go.
Were you worried about coming down? Because it's almost like climbing a tree. You know, it's okay when you're on your way up, and then you realize it's like, oh, God, I've still got to get down.
Oh, yes. If you worry about it, you shouldn't be there. You know things can go wrong. So your worry is about making a mistake in that process. Your worry is not dying. Your fear is not to die. Your fear is that you're going to make a mistake. When stuff goes wrong, so you just, you're focused, you're concentrated, and when you land, you're like, well, that was that. You know, 2 weeks goes, for me, 2 weeks by really, really fast.
Were you relieved to get down?
No. Well, I was sick when I came back. I couldn't stand up. I was really nauseated. Didn't like being back in 1G in gravity. It felt weird. Maybe I was a little dehydrated because you lose liquid in space. Your body thinks you have too much liquid because it's all floating. And so when you come back, you have a deficit, and so you try and replenish that fluid. And I was the bartender. You know, I had these bags of drinks. They were...
I'm guessing they weren't cocktails.
No, they weren't cocktails. No, they were you know, it was water with salt. You had salt tablets and water, so you absorb the water, not just drink the water. And so I was passing out all the stuff on the flight deck to the commander and the pilot and to me. I drank everything I was supposed to, but I probably was more dehydrated than I thought. So when I came back, heart was racing, and it was real uncomfortable for about a week.
Can you think of one particular moment? I love stories on this podcast. Can you think of one particular standout moment of your time in space?
Yeah, I was told there's a gentleman named Jerry Ross, one of two astronauts that flown on the shuttle 7 times, and Jerry was my boss, and he said, you know, at some point in your spacewalks, stop and sear the image into your mind. And do not take a picture of it. Take a picture with your mind. And I did that on the end of the space station. And in the movie, they're recreating this this moment where I was on the end of the space station. For me, as a rock climber, it was the ultimate cliff. You know, it's a long ways down. But I was looking out across the limb of the Earth, over the edge of the Earth, out into the vastness of the universe, thinking, you know, what else is out there? You know, we cannot be alone in this vast universe that we inhabit a very small portion of. And so it was that moment that was nothing between me and whatever else is out there. And that was an OG whiz goosebump, you know. Wow.
What do you think is out there?
There's life has to be out there. I mean, the probability is so great given the number of stars in the visible universe. They say for every grain of sand on the surface of the Earth, there's a star in the visible universe. I mean, just go out and grab a handful of sand and try and contemplate that. And, you know, the probability is so great. As a mathematician, probability and statistics, you know, we can't be alone. You know, we can't be so special that it's just us. I certainly do not believe that we're alone in the universe.
Do you think that there's anything watching us?
If it's a long ways away, you know, the closest star is like 4.5 light years away. So that's 70,000 years at our current propulsion. If we were going there, it would take 70,000 years to get to the closest star. You know, if anything's looking at us, I mean, it's a long ways away.
It's just crazy, isn't it? It's crazy to contemplate. And as, you know, an astronaut, is it still crazy to contemplate?
Well, yeah. Well, life on the Earth is pretty bizarre, right? We have things existing on the Earth in places they shouldn't, that we think they should not exist, but they do. Yeah, they've evolved to be like the depths of the ocean. Things thrive, the greatest pressures, no sunlight, and stuff thrives because of what's coming out of the Earth. Why can't that happen on Europa or Titan, you know, somewhere in our solar system or around a planet and around another star? I think, yeah, if it happens here, it's got to happen out there. It's the same process, the same elements, the same type of things that we're made of exist out in those stars.
I've been exposed recently to a train of thought that says that life forms from other planet were here before us. What do you think about that?
You know, there's a lot of people that have a lot of shows that have these ideas that aliens came here and did stuff that we couldn't do. No. You know, and from my culture, from my heritage, I came from ancestors that built these remarkable structures by hand. And for someone to come and tell me, oh, they couldn't have done that, it had to be aliens, I take serious issue with that and like to have a long conversation about that.
Well, this seems a great point to talk about your Native American heritage, because you're the first Native American astronaut. Mm-hmm. And tell us about your heritage.
Well, I come from a tribe which is now in Oklahoma. It used to be called Indian Territory. My tribe is a Chickasaw Nation. They originally came from somewhere in the southeast of the United States, before it was the United States. Kind of a mound culture. They built these remarkable earthen mounds. From pretty much the eastern United States, there was a huge mound civilization, mound culture that existed long before European, Western civilization came to our shores. So my tribe was engineers. They were scientists. They were, a lot of Native peoples were just that. They were building structures when Europe was in the Dark Ages. And they were very successful at what they did. Things still stand today. My tribe, those mounds still exist. So I like to think that I come from ancestors who were remarkable scientists, engineers, persistent, and able to survive when all the odds were against them, and many, many times. So I think that's what I bring from what my ancestors provided for me.
And what was life growing up for you?
I was born in Oklahoma, but I moved away early on. My heritage and my Chickasaw heritage comes from my mother's side of the family. My great-grandmother's full-blood Chickasaw. But I've always been very proud of my heritage, but I grew up outside of the tribe. I lived in Colorado. I grew up in the mountains, Wyoming. I lived in Texas for a bit. Went back to Colorado for university. And so I always liked being outside. I've always liked this idea of being in nature and being in the mountains.
Yeah. So you have done an incredible amount of traveling. I don't really know where to start from that. Obviously, there was the big bike ride.
Yeah.
What were you doing before that? And then tell us about the bike ride.
Sure. Well, I flew in space in 2002. I was in the Navy for 13 years before I was selected to NASA. I was at NASA for 6 years before I flew. So I had a variety of jobs. I flew in space in 2002. Mission after mine was Columbia. I lost 7 friends on Columbia. I lost 3 were my classmates. We didn't fly for about 2.5 years. I was training for a space station mission. I was going to fly with 2 Russians. I was a commander, backup commander to a Russian guy, Pavel Vinogradov. I have a little bone mass in my back, osteoporosis, and so I got disqualified from long duration. Could have flown a shuttle, but we weren't flying a shuttle, so I made a really tough decision to retire in 2005. Went to work for a commercial space company, the idea of flying paying passengers in space. I went to a company that was owned by a millionaire, not a billionaire. Makes a difference.
Just a millionaire, billionaires,
they call them. Hopped on a bicycle in 2008, celebrate my 50th birthday. I rode from Cape Flattery to Cape Canaveral. And along the way, I stopped and talked to Native Americans at different reservations and schools, NASA schools as well, to talk about my road to the astronaut corps. When I didn't do really well in school my first year in college and university. I wasn't motivated. I got kicked out, actually, for low grade. But I went to work in the mountains. I worked for a surveying firm, and I saw math in practice for the first time in my life. I worked for a guy that took an interest in me and decided, encouraged me to go back to school. So I did, and went on to earn a degree in mathematics, and then went on to join the Navy, and then flew in the Navy as a test pilot. Just had this kind of interesting career that took me along, but by the time I was 50, and this idea of riding the bike to tell that story, hopefully make the difference in the lives of students, that if this is something you want to pursue, if you have a desire to do something that may be out of the realm of what you think is possible, well, it's not necessarily true. You can do it, but certain people help you in your life and encourage you, make a difference.
And you now work as a motivational speaker, and I can see where that journey has, you experienced that, flunking out of college and actually turning it around because of one person, one situation. It's incredible how things like that can turn your whole life around.
Sure. Yeah, I had one young lady stop me once in Phoenix, Arizona. I was on an elevator, and she goes, "You're John Harrington." And that does not happen to me. People don't recognize me. But she said, I met you when I was 12 years old, and I didn't realize that I could be an engineer until I met you. And she says, "I want to thank you, because I'm now an engineer with the city of San Francisco as a civil engineer."
I always say that if you can't see it growing up, you know, whether that's because you're in poverty, living in a certain area, sure. living with a certain culture that aren't, you know, as prevalent on TV or in the industries you want to be in. If you can't see it, you don't know you can be it.
Right. Yeah.
Even if you want to be it,
sure.
you can't see a path to get there.
Well, I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. I watched astronauts on TV, but I didn't see any of them that looked like me. And so, you know, I dreamed about being an astronaut, but I never thought I could pursue it until much later in my career when I was doing the same thing those guys had done. I was in the exact same school, same test pilot school, doing the exact same thing. And so the reality is, yeah, I can do this, but if you don't apply, you won't be one. You know, so I went down that path, you know, later in life. Yeah,
so many kids dream about being an astronaut, but yeah. I don't think they actually dream they can actually be an astronaut. It's almost like Father Christmas, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's one of those sort of like ridiculous. But you actually, anyone listening to this, anyone's children can be an astronaut.
Sure.
You just have to know that path and follow it.
Yeah, I like to say, do the very best you can do, and if it leads you down that path to doing something you dream about, that's fabulous. But I know folks that have gone down that path and did not become astronauts. And they felt, from what I can tell, they felt really disappointed in it, obviously. But at the same time, they had fabulous careers. And so this idea is do something you love to do. Do something to get paid to do something you love to do.
Absolutely.
And
it's like
fabulous.
The people that love playing football and they get so far, but they're never going to be the rock star footballer
yeah.
or the musician is never
yeah.
going to have a number one single, but they might be earning a living out of making music. It's
sure.
exactly the same thing, isn't
sure.
it? So you're here in the UK at the moment
yeah.
because you're doing a world tour, by the sounds of it. You're flitting around all over the place. Talking about the film, tell me about your film.
Sure. Well, about a year ago, I received a call from a group named McGillivray Freeman Films. They do IMAX movies, giant screen films. And they were interested in pursuing being a talent with a young lady named Ariel Tweedo. Ariel is a Inupiaq, Inuit, an Eskimo from Alaska, who's been on a TV show called Flying Wild Alaska. And they asked if we'd be interested in going across the country and going to places that were kind of off the beaten path. Yeah, well, signed me up. It was great. It was a fabulous experience. So we travel across the country going to places and filming places and not just talking about the beauty of the place, but talking about the cultural aspect of the place, talking about something unique to that area that folks may not have known about. And so we've gone from the West Coast to the East Coast. We've gone New York from north, from the Finger Lakes of New York, down to Shiprock, Arizona. I've driven a Corvette down Route 66. So this has been a really fabulous experience.
What has been the most surprising thing that you've discovered about America?
The most surprising thing? Well, I think when I rode the bike across the country, I experienced meeting people. I experienced the heat and the cold, the snow, the lightning, all that. And you really appreciate just the folks you meet along the way. That's the neat part about it is that you may not be familiar with the spot, but you stop and talk to somebody that is and say, hey, where should I go? And they point in that direction. So that's the one thing that I found is that, you know, talk to the folks that are there, you know, and you'll learn a lot about something you had no idea about before.
That's the thing about the vastness of America, isn't it? I mean, people take the piss out of Americans, a great proportion not having passports. But when you've got such vastness of landscape and people and geographical spread, everything is there.
But not everything. You know, there's so many beautiful things to do, but the idea is to get folks around as many places as you can. So what we want to do in the United States is show folks these kind of places that are off the beaten path that we may appreciate because we live there. But folks that have never been there may had no idea that it was there. So they actually came and filmed up my house in central Idaho. And the central Idaho is this absolutely gorgeous mountainous area that's, you know, I have wilderness on both sides of my house, you know, where I live. In an airplane, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump, and I can fly my plane back in there.
You've got your own plane?
I got a small plane,
Hi.
Yeah. I did that when I retired. I had to keep flying. 2 weeks ago, I was rowing a boat, a rubber raft, on the Lower Salmon River in Idaho with a good friend of mine who's an outfitter, and we were taking clients down the Lower Salmon in this absolutely gorgeous canyon. I get to live there, you know, so then it's neat to be able to share that with people.
You do get to live there, which is amazing, but because you've got this incredible backstory and lifestyle, you also get to go to these wonderful places
mm-hmm.
around the world.
Yeah, I get to see a lot of people and experience different cultures and get an appreciation for what other people have. I think that's one of the neatest things about me when I was in the Navy. I got to go to places I never dreamed I would get to go to, and I got to see them and talk to people that were from there, and that gives you an appreciation for you're just not that special where you are. Everybody else has a story. And that's anything about traveling is you get to learn those stories and you get to take that home with you.
Which is why travel helps, yeah. as we were saying before, with, you know, prejudice and, mm-hmm. you know, making us all feel a little bit more connected.
More people need to do it. You know, the United States is a gorgeous place, a lot of fabulous things. I would love my family to get out and be able to see that. My folks lived overseas. My mom and dad lived in Morocco before. My brother was in West Africa. My sister, when she was little, was over there as well. And so they've had a chance to, you know, to experience living outside the United States. I want my grandkids to be able to do that. I want my grandkids to experience what it's like to go to Europe, what it's like to go to Africa, what it's like to go to South America. Those are places, some places I haven't been, but I still want to go. Yeah.
What we were talking about earlier about you can't be something or do something if you don't see it.
Sure.
So, but a lot of the time it's about money, isn't it?
Yeah.
Travel is expensive.
It's so expensive.
But there are ways of doing it, even if you don't come from a rich family. I certainly don't come from a rich family. I don't know about your background. Your parents sound like you've traveled. There are ways of doing it. If you do have those people around you that are traveling out of the village or the state or the country, you know, there are ways of doing it, of traveling, of saving up, of going into the Navy.
Sure.
You just have to find something that inspires you to want to work hard to do it.
Yeah, riding a bike, the fuel is your food. You know, you're not driving a car. And so you get up every morning and you go as far as you can, as far as you want to, and you pick those little places and you meet the people along the way. You may pitch a tent in a city park because, you know, if you're going to stay in a hotel, if you have the money, you don't. You pitch your tent in the park. Next morning I dust the ice off my tent and it's in the fog. And this is in Colorado. I pedal out of the fog into this beautiful sunshine near Rocky Mountain National Park. And then it gets cloudy and then it starts to rain and then it snows. And it lightnings, and it sleets. So I had this incredible sensory experience in these bunch of different seasons, and it was fabulous. I was on a bike.
I've had a lot of people, not a lot of people, I've had a few other people, adventurers, you know, like yourself on the podcast, that have said they've just got their bike and gone, you know. And I think it's just so simple, yet so terrifying, and you can just do it. There's nothing to stop you. Obviously, social constraints and a little bit of cash, you know, to keep you going. But there's nothing from stopping anyone from just getting on a bike right now and going, or walking and just keeping on going.
Yeah, there's I live in a place where it's called the Trans-America Route. And so people go from Astoria, Oregon to go out to the East Coast. They actually have a race. And so in the summer, I see these folks racing across the country. And sometimes they're just folks that they're fully loaded bikes and they're just cranking down and I stop and I'll talk to them because I did it and I want to hear their story. And people, it's just fun. You start sharing the stories. And maybe somebody from Germany. And maybe somebody from Belgium. And maybe somebody, I met a guy in Montana who was pedaling, he's Japanese, pedaling from Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, to Tierra del Fuego, Argentina. I met him in Montana. He'd already pedaled farther in his bike ride than I was going to do my entire bike ride. And that was fun.
So when you are there in the wilderness where you live, and you know, it sounds like you're close to some very interesting places and people pass through, do you ever look up at the sky and think, oh, I went there?
Well, yeah, sometimes I woke up, we were on the river, and I was sleeping on my boat. And we look up, you see the Milky Way, you know, floating overhead. You know, so we rotate underneath the Milky Way, it moves across the sky. And then I had have the app. And even though I was in the wilderness, my app still had the forecast for when the space station would come over. And I look down the canyon, and I see the space station come out of the one side of the mountain, cross the canyon, and pop over the other side. And you go, yeah, I know those guys.
That's your wife.
Yeah.
What travel, it's very difficult to narrow it down because you've got so many travel stories, but what travel stories have I missed? What should I ask you?
Oh, boy. I have very good friends, a French test pilot named Philippe Perrin. I'm the godfather to his second daughter, and he lives in Toulouse, France. He's a test pilot for Airbus. He was one of my classmates in the astronaut class, and he has a place in southern France in the Gorge de Tarn, on the Tarn River, a place called Castelbouc, and it's this gorgeous little teeny village at the base of a medieval castle. And I got to go there for his daughter's for baptism. And that was one of the most fabulous trips I've ever had, is to go down to and to be there with people whose history is there and to see that. That's one of my favorite trips. Yeah.
You said you weren't scared in space because you're trained not to be scared. Where in the world have you felt afraid?
Oh, boy. I used to be stationed in Alaska, and we used to do search and rescue missions off of the island we were We were lost on a search and rescue mission off of, we were flying off the Soviet Union, and we were pulled off our mission to go search for a Korean freighter that was sinking in a hurricane force winds. And I'm down at 300 feet at night, getting the beat out of me in the airplane. It was just incredibly bumpy, but we found the ship. And, you know, you're thinking if something happened, we'd be down and no one would know what ever happened to us. And so you're so focused on your job, you know, that you start thinking about the stuff that could go bad. Same thing about being in the shuttle, is that you don't focus on that. But I did have one time where I had a malfunction with the airplane, and there's a chance that it was very scary that the plane I flew had a problem years ago where the wings would fall off. They fixed it.
That's quite
but,
a problem.
Yeah, but it happened on a flight, on a search and rescue again, where something happened. It was really strange, and we had this really weird oscillation in the airplane. And it turns out we had these cracks in the wings we didn't know about until after we came back. But it could have been in the middle of, you know, the Arctic, not the Arctic Ocean, but the Gulf of Alaska, where something could have happened. We would have disappeared, and no one happened to us.
That would be a cold and nasty death.
Cold, yeah, terrible.
So where have you felt happiest in the world?
Boy. Play with my grandson, and we have a little Segways, little two-wheel Segways, and where I live, and nice little neighborhood, well, in the mountains. It's a small community, and my grandson and I get on the Segways and go zipping around, walking my dog. So I'm really happy being with my grandson, my kids, in a place that I love, living in the mountains, going skiing. I love to ski. Love snow skiing. Ride my bike, yeah.
Sounds absolutely perfect. I have one last question for you, and my question is always about music, because I think that music and travel, I don't know about space travel, it's going to be, for me, it would be Space Odyssey. I always think that music and travel go hand in hand.
Sure.
If you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable
time
or place of travel, what would that song be?
There's a really neat song by Willie Nelson, and it's a African group. Still Traveling to Me, I think, is the name of it. And I played this once as part of a slideshow that I did for my bike ride across the country, and it's, you know, Still Moving to Me, and it's this, got this, I'm still moving, and I'm still going down the road, and I'd love to use a song. It's one, I don't have permission to use a song, so I don't use it, but it's got this really beautiful rhythm to it, and as Willie Nelson's talking about, you know, you're moving on, going on down the road, and the next thing you get to see. And I think it's Still Moving to Me, and it's off of Putumayo album. Boy, I wish I knew it. It's Still Moving to Me, I think, is the name of it.
Well, I don't have permission to use it either, but we'll have to
look it up
and think of it in our imaginations when we think about your journey. And thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Oh, this is fabulous. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, John, for being such an inspiration. Coming up in the next few episodes, we have a famous Burmese chef, a famous explorer and his wife, and I'm possibly introducing a review section to the podcast, so do watch this space.